Welcome, guys, to episode 99 of Behind the Show podcast. My name's James Gearing, and this week I bring to you my second interview with Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, who is highly respected in military law enforcement and other fields when it comes to the psychology of killing, psychology of combat, and also the violence that we're seeing in our schools. So we were about to sit down for our interview, and I received a text from my stepson, Ethan, who is at the local high school just down the road from our house. We started hearing all these sirens and these police cars and rescues flying by, and being a firefighter, I had a very, you know, sickening feeling in my stomach that something was very, very wrong, and they were all headed towards that direction, and there's really only one main building over there, which is his high school. So then we got some texts from him, and I'm going to read them to you to kind of set up the premise for this interview today. The front office is getting shot. There are shots. Don't call me, we're hiding. I'll be safe. I love you. I'll be fine. I've got a way to defend myself, even if they come to the library of all places. I'm in the library in the dark. I hear radio saying they need security immediately in the front office. I hear a lot of choppers, and the sirens have gone away already. So, as it happened, that was a false alarm. However, the neighboring high school, just a further to the east in Ocala, actually had an active killer, a murderer, come in, an ex-student, with the intent of killing as many students as he could. So, this is happening all over the place, and it's funny because I almost thought about releasing this at certain times, but the irony is almost every single week we're seeing this happening somewhere around the country now. And we're throwing up our arms, and then, you know, the social media wars begin of pro-gun, anti-gun, you know, and all these other elements. And what I love about Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman is he has some solutions, and he is not by any means saying that what we talk about are the only reasons. But there are reasons, and they're delving into some of the backstory of some of these shootings. And I think that's what we really need to open our mind to. We can't just play the game, the blame game. We can't just lock away all the guns. We can't assume that every single person, you know, is in a state of psychosis. There are all these factors, but we need to look at all these factors and address them. So I'm not here to preach to you. I am not an expert. I'm merely just someone who wants to help fix this problem myself and be part of the solution. But Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman has been called in by every walk of life. And prior to this interview, I believe he was sitting down with President Trump addressing this very issue. So with that slightly elongated introduction out of the way, I wanted to set it up because you'll hear us discussing this in the interview. So listen, be open-minded, and then look around, you know, and evaluate, you know, what are your kids doing? What are the kids in the community doing? You know, are we helping or are we hurting in some of these scenarios? So as I always say, please go to iTunes, rate the show, please share the show. But without further ado, I introduce to you Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman. Enjoy. Welcome back to the podcast, Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman. It's funny, I got that right this time. Last time when we had the first recording, I called you Lieutenant Dave Grossman. So that's an improvement already. So where are we finding you on planet Earth today?
You know, I just got back from Dallas. I had 3 days in Dallas doing the NRA show there. We spoke on the Bulletproof Mind for the Armed Citizen on 3 days. And then before that, I was in Artesia, New Mexico, at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, Artesia West there, training a bunch of federal agents. And I forget where I was before that, but I had a full week on the road, and I'm home for just 2 nights and back out again.
Wow. So you're back in Chicago then at the moment?
Well, actually, you know what? We live outside of St. Louis. You know, when we tell people we live in Illinois, they just immediately think Chicago. You know, you get 100 miles away from Chicago, and it's a pretty neat state, you know, anywhere south of there. But we're outside of St. Louis on the wrong side of the river there, the St. Clair County outside of the Scott Air Force Base.
Brilliant. All right. Well, so let's talk about that first then. So we were supposed to record just over a week ago, and I called you guys and said that I had to cancel. And it's so ironic because it's exactly what we're one of the things that we're going to be talking about. We had to cancel because we actually had a school shooting here in Ocala. Now, I'd had a bizarre instance about 3 months prior where I dropped my son off after a doctor's appointment, and we got stuck in the school because they had a code, what they call a code red, which for them is an active shooter. It ended up being a false alarm, but I had such a unique perspective of what it was like to be a first responder on the inside of a school during one of these events. And you see how vulnerable these kids are. You see how there's no communication and how just terrifying it must be. And I've said this in a podcast before. I was literally looking around this room we were in, and there was one of those paper guillotines, and I was going in my head thinking about how I'm going to pull the blade off and use it as a machete. And it was crazy. But what was sad was a few months later, when we were supposed to have ours, we actually had one. So we got texts from our teenage son saying, "I hear gunshots, you know, we're all hiding now, we're in the dark, someone's shooting up the front." And it's the most terrifying text you can receive as a parent. It ended up being that his school and my younger son's school, who also spent a good part of their morning in the dark, hiding under desks, not sure if they were ever going to see their parents again, those two were false alarms. But one of the other high schools we had in Ocala was a real one, and a kid shot through a door, hit one young man in the ankle. I think luckily it was not a serious injury, but from what I understand, there was some sort of weapon malfunction or something that made the shooter drop his gun and give up. But it had every intention, from what I believe, of carrying through yet another event. So I just kind of want to open with that discussion, because it's just so bizarre that I had to cancel our talk because of that.
Where is that? Where do you live at, James?
So we're in Ocala in Florida, which is about an hour north of Orlando.
Yeah. You know, I guess kind of one beginning point that I can bring some perspective to that is, nationwide, we're working real hard to get rid of the phrase active shooter response. You know, I tell people, whenever you hear that phrase active shooter response, laugh at them and tell them we'd be real busy during deer season. You know, first off, we're not going to wait until he starts shooting. You know, ideally, we want to take action long before he starts pulling the trigger. We want to intercept him. So, you know, we're encouraging nationwide, and we're making great movement, called active intruder. Also, you know, shooters are not bad. You know, shooting is not a criminal act. If we call the Columbine shooting, the Parkland shooting, if shooting is a term for a mass murderer, then, you know, it's kind of, I know you're beginning to make that movement down that path of arming and training yourself. You know, shooting is not a criminal act. It's kind of anti-gun propaganda, but it also traps us mentally that we've got to wait until he starts shooting. And what if the kid's got knives? Kid in Pennsylvania slashed 21 people with knives in his school. Kid in Colorado had firebombs, Molotov cocktails, running down the hallway, throwing firebombs. So, just kind of think about how our language guides us, and the whole phrase of active shooter, that, you know, and that shootings are not a criminal act. When we talk about response to this, across America, one of the things we're doing is arming educators, and it's costing nothing. 85% of the counties in Ohio have some armed educators. And it's cost them nothing. They've got a program of training that they take. It's great. It's called FASTER. Look up the acronym FASTER. A guy named Dick Castor is doing the training. The teacher provides the weapon and the ammo. The training is donated. They're doing it in Colorado, also the FASTER program. I do a lot of work in Utah. I don't think there's a school left in Utah that doesn't have armed educators. You know, those Mormons said, do they love their kids more than we do? I don't know, but they take it seriously. And they think it's just a no-brainer. There's one or two people in every school that ought to be carrying a gun. And they've been doing that closing on 20 years. The superintendent, the principal, makes a call, and decentralized and empowering down at the lowest levels. Nobody's being forced to carry a gun, of course. It's those who have the skills and demonstrate it. I was just in Texas. every year, Texas has more and more armed educators. They train them in the summer. They put them in the schools. They call them their school marshals. It's like the sky marshal. Somebody that plane has a gun. You don't know who. You don't know when. And, you know, we've never had a multiple homicide in a school when there's somebody in the building that could shoot back. In Columbine, the cop never got in the building. And of course, in Parkland, the cop didn't go in the building. And, you know, the cop's being sued for that, rightfully so. What would you say if you were on the jury? You know, given the info you have now, you know, I think you and I would nail him to the ground like a tent stake, because not going in while children are being slaughtered. But it represents a leadership flaw and a training flaw. We want people who are trained to go in. We want warriors. We want sheepdogs. You don't say, oh, no, we don't want warriors. We want guardians. You know, you need to develop that warrior spirit. I'm going in and I'm going to lay my life down for these kids if I have to. But for that one case when the cop didn't go in, we had the one in Maryland this year where the cop went in like thunder and shot the perpetrator. The perp had shot two people. One died, God bless it. We had solo homicide in that school because the cop went in like thunder. We had a case last fall, this school year, in Spokane, Washington, where the janitor hammered the kid with a broom from behind, and the school resource officer there was in seconds and cuffed him. We had a case in Illinois, my home state, just a little north of us here, where a 49-year-old female PE teacher tackled the kid, and the school resource officer was there in seconds and cuffed him. So, and these are just the ones we know about, where the SRO is stopping crimes. So just recognize that there's an array of possible things we could do to prepare for that. The president, after Parkland, talked about armed educators, and the media acted like it was insane. But I wish the bastards of the media would, like, give us news. I believe every state in America has some armed educators. Most of them are. I worked in a school in Massachusetts recently with armed educators, public school. But private schools, now the only exception is California. California had two school districts with armed educators, and the state passed the law to stop them from doing that. Other than California, which had two school districts with armed educators, every state in America has some form of armed educators. And I'm not saying that's right for your school, but recognizing there's a continuum of responses, and the media's refusal to give us information is just horrendously frustrating. A crime identical to Parkland happened in 2002 in Erfurt, Germany. A 19-year-old high school dropout comes into school, murders 17 people. Isn't that worthy of reporting in the news? The exact same crime happened in Germany. 19-year-old high school dropout comes to school, murders 17, including himself. The all-time record juvenile mass murder, you know, the 19-year-old in Parkland and the 19-year-old in Erfurt, Germany, don't qualify for our record juvenile mass murder. The all-time record juvenile mass murder was 2009 in Binnen, Germany, when a 17-year-old high school student murdered 15. Germany has the strictest gun laws in Europe. And yet the all-time record juvenile mass murder in school, juvenile mass murder period, was in Germany. And a crime identical to Parkland happened in Germany. So when politicians tell us we'll make the bad man go away with those gun laws, they're lying to us. Why don't we make it against the law to shoot people? Oh, it is against the law. Why don't we make it against the law to bring a gun into school? Ah, it is against the law. Another law is not going to stop this crime. And Germany can't stop kids from committing these crimes. No way in America are you going to prevent anybody getting access to a weapon. But what we can do is empower educators and empower parents and empower kids to take action. We're teaching the kids what to do. You know, if we don't teach kids what to do, we're teaching them to do nothing. And so we're teaching them throw something and get out the door, get out of there, take action. And that's a positive step. Run, hide, fight is a good setup. And it's a set of options. It's not a sequence. It's a set of options that we use. The first two to die at Sandy Hook were two female unarmed educators who charged the killer. The principal and another educator just charged out and were gunned down. One principal told me, he said, I will die for my kids right now, like those two. Give me something beside my keys in my hand. when the killer comes to murder my children. I will die for them. Give me something beside my keys in my hand. A school district in Alabama has given every educator pepper spray and training them with it. We recommend go to Amazon.com, look at Saber Red Pepper Gel. It's a straight stream. There's no cross contamination. It dyes their face. If you want something in their hands right now, every educator, anybody you know who's an educator, get them a can of go to Amazon.com, Saber Band, S-A-B-R-E. They're the ones military and law enforcement use. They're the only ones with really good quality control. They've got great products. It's against the rules. I'm not allowed that pepper spray. It's never been enforced. If you pull out a can of pepper spray at the moment of truth and give the bad guy a shot in the face, I guarantee you, nobody's asking where it came from. Oh, I happen to have a can of pepper spray in her purse. He had a can of pepper spray in his jacket. Nobody's thinking anything of it. James said they're doing goofy stuff like putting wasp spray in every classroom. Yeah, we're not allowed to have pepper spray, but we'd have wasp spray. See, really, we're going to spray the bad guy with this stuff. Well, best I can tell, there's two kinds of wasp spray out there. One is like shooting with a squirt gun. The other one is maybe game over, die on cockroach, he's dead right now. We should not give every teacher deadly force. So if you carefully train, carefully select the teachers, maybe. But give them pepper spray. And regardless of the rules, a little civil disobedience that nobody's going to care about, every educator out there, start carrying pepper spray, something in their hands beside their keys when they come to kill our kids. So there's actions we can be taking, empowering our children, empowering our educators. But, we come back to Parkland. How do you get in the door? How do you get in the door with the rifle? In Jonesboro, this is the 20th anniversary of Jonesboro, an 11 and 13-year-old boy stole a van. They could barely look over the dashboard. They could barely reach the gas pedals. They stole a van. They drove across town. They broke into a law enforcement officer's house. They drove back across town. They put themselves in a kill position overlooking the playground. The 11-year-old boy pops in the back door and pulls the fire alarm. Stop. What'd he do? Popped in the back door. If the door had been locked, the crime would not have been possible. Here we are 20 years later, Parkland. How'd he get in the door? It's too hard to keep the doors locked and control who works in our building. Half the cost of the building goes into fire code. Not a kid in America has been killed by school fire in over 50 years. Half the cost of the building goes into fire code, but it's too hard to keep the doors locked. Now, the sheriff and the superintendent has blood on their hands. So the superintendent in Parkland knows that he should have had the doors locked and control who walked in the building. The sheriff knew that he should have had cops that went in like thunder and shot that killer. They had blood on their hands. And the first thing to do is start pointing the finger at the evil guns. They gotta point the finger somewhere else. The media, the evil TV shows and the movies and especially the video games are a key piece of the equation. The Parkland killer played video games. The neighbor said played violent video games 15 hours a day. Quote, it was kill, kill, kill every minute of every day, playing violent video games. Isn't that an important aspect of understanding what happened? Instead of blaming the object, let's look at the individual and see what he did with his life. But the media knows they have blood on their hands, and they got to point the finger somewhere else immediately. And so the guns are just an object. And England, we had a month last, 2 months ago, England had more murders in London than New York, and they're all knife murders. Now the ban on knives in England, there's no reason why any citizen should carry a knife. They've got chefs on TV. There's no culinary reason why any knife should be longer than 3 inches. When do we stop blaming the object and start focusing on what's in the life and the mind of the individual? A guy wrote a book, Inside the Mind of a Teen Killer, and he surveyed 21 teen or over 100 teen killers, and every time they had one thing in common, an obsession with media violence. So here we got the media with blood on their hands. We got the superintendent with blood on their hands. We got the sheriff whose people failed to perform, and the first thing they all do is start pointing the finger at the guns, when in reality, across America, we've got armed educators, and we've had 100% success with that.
Yeah, well, I want to point out the officer that was attributed to stopping the one we had here was Marion County Sheriff's Deputy Jimmy Long. So I want to give him a kind of shout out. But he was obviously one of an entire team that then responded, and they did an incredible job.
Now, there's, I didn't hear about that. he went in the door and tell me what happened, please.
He went towards the gunfire. Now, like I said, I don't think he was faced with gunfire because from, you know, whatever happened, the kid, I believe, had dropped the weapon by that point. However, he went towards the initial gunfire. But that's another thing that I wanted to ask you about as well, is the you know, the prevention side of having a uniformed armed officer at these schools too, because it, with the educators being armed, I see how that's definitely dissuading to a shooter. But having an officer with body armor and you know, just a visual deterrent, I think is very powerful as well.
Absolutely. But again, you know, you use that phrase shooter. You know, we're in denial. These are killers.
Yes. Let me rephrase it. Killers.
Yeah. It took me years to retrain myself from using that phrase. But, you know, again, the officer's a shooter. The perpetrator is an attempted murderer. But you're quite right. The problem is that we don't have the money to put one in every school. An armed cop in every school is a worthy investment. Now, remember, half the cost of a modern building goes into fire code. Fireproof material for the structure of the building versus the cheapest alternative, fire sprinkler system under pressure with the light up in the building, electrical system brought up to fire code, double the electrical system to run wiring to every fire exit and every smoke alarm. And then think about the money for the fire alarm system. A separate network of wiring runs through our whole civilization from every fire alarm to the fire guy. And then the fire hydrant. There's a separate network of huge pipes that runs to every fire hydrant. I mean, think of the money we spend as a civilization to prepare for fire. So it's not unreasonable to spend the money to have a cop in every school. And yet what happens is in a few years, they say, oh, we don't want that. We don't need that. And then we got the people who talk about, well, we got the school to prison pipeline. We got cops in the school that arrest the kid that. And they go straight to prison, and it's all the evil cop's fault. And he sent them right to prison. If we didn't have a cop there, they wouldn't go to prison. Bullshit. You know, they're committing violent crimes. I think there's evidence to believe that the superintendent and the sheriff conspired to conceal crimes in that school. I think if the information I've seen is accurate, and I think you may end up seeing that sheriff, that superintendent in jail, and I hope so if it's accurate information.
You mean the Parkland one?
The Parkland, okay. Yeah, there's really cause to believe that they conspired to conceal crime because, we got this school-to-prison pipeline, and once they hit a certain point, they stopped reporting felonious acts to keep the numbers down. Things are bad. Criminal action's happening. And the response of the school too often is to hide it. When we have a cop in the school, we can't hide it. And so you've got all kinds of craziness going on out there that, you know, that a year or two from now, we don't have the budget to pay for the school resource officer. You know, the vast amounts of money going to fire prevention is too much money to pay the budget for a cop. So you're right. Cop in every school is the best answer. And in an ideal world, we'd allocate the funds. It's nothing compared to the amount of money we pay for fire prevention. So yes, it's a worthy endeavor, and if we could do it, we'd do it. But again, armed educators, you know, in the state of Ohio are free, Texas free, Utah free. Across America, they're doing it for nothing, and so it becomes the Israeli model: armed educators and armed people everywhere charging to the sound of the guns. Israel can't afford to put an armed cop in every school, but they can afford. Well, actually, they do to some degree, but they can't afford to have armed educators everywhere they go. So there's a variety of tools that we can apply. We're not helpless. We have a lot that we can do. And people say, oh, we can't prevent it. Yes, you can. And the first thing, as you say, is to deter the killer, to have something in place that says, I'm not going to get a body count here, so I'm not going to try.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I think that's a huge thing. And what's sad is I've had this issue with the fire side. I mean, obviously the prevention is well done, but the actual response, I mean, they close down stations all the time. The guys have got to beg for equipment. And then the PD side, as I'm being more exposed to now, and we'll talk about this later, but with the sheepdog response and some of those things, you learn that my fellow law enforcement officers, and I'm a firefighter, I'm not pretending I understand it, but you learn that they only get so much ammunition, they only get to qualify in a range twice a year, they only ride one to a car. And then you ask yourself, as a community, when your child is at risk, do you care about that $100 you saved on your taxes because some politician sold you a budget? And to me, it's like we need to reprogram the way we think as a society and prioritize what's most important and give the best resources to FD, PD, EMS to allow them to save our families when it matters.
And you know, the fire guys really are a student, you know, not a single kid but killed by school fire in half a century. You know, what they've done is they've written it into the law with the fire code. So there's a model in place. You know, once it gets written into the law, it becomes accepted. You know, we live with it. You know, they wouldn't buckle their baby in the car seat if it wasn't the law. It becomes the law. We find the money, get the car seat. We find car seats for them. It becomes the law to have your fire code, have fire sprinklers and fire exits. And so I think there's a great model in place if we really care that we get this public safety. The baseline of every government is public safety. You know, the Pharaoh, the Roman Empire, the social contract says you obey the law, you pay your taxes, we'll help keep you safe. You know, the marauding barbarians, the criminals within, you know, that's what civilization does. You pay your taxes, you obey the law, we'll help keep you safe. If we can't keep them safe, the contract breaks down. Why should we pay your taxes? Why should we obey your law when you can't even keep us safe? So the very social contract is being frayed by this crime. Something to understand here is the number of people murdered has been coming down every year for a decade because of medical technology. You know, tactical combat casualty care in just the last decade has got the body count of the battlefield has been cut in half by innovations in just the last decade on saving lives. And the same thing's true in our street. We've got a UMass Harvard study that's 20 years old. It tells us if we had 1970s technology, the murder rate would be four times what it is. So the murder rate's been coming down year after year. And then in the last 2 years, something horrible happened. In 2015, we had 1,700 more Americans murdered the year before. And that number should be going down. In 2016, we had 1,300 more Americans murdered the year before. Now, we'll get the 2017 data in August. But it looks like it's going to be just as bad. It should be going down. And it's compound interest on top of the previous year. The FBI, we've been building up this for a very long time. But the FBI calls it the Ferguson effect. For 2 years straight, the homicide rate has exploded like nothing we have ever seen before. And there's this sense of anger in our criminals. Like the cop's the bad guy for enforcing the law. And we've got entire states that say, oh, you don't have to obey the law in our state, sanctuary states and sanctuary cities. And, you know, a Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis said crime is contagious. If government becomes a lawbreaker, it breeds contempt for the law. If every man for himself, it breeds chaos. And that's where we're at with these sanctuary cities and sanctuary states, regardless of the justness of their cause, their methodology of saying you don't have to obey the law, does great harm to the fabric of our civilization. So we're in tragically lawless times with the homicide rate exploding, with lawlessness exploding, with school violence exploding. But remember, it's worldwide. And there's one new factor in the equation, and that's the sick media and the stories we tell our kids. You know, gang membership has exploded in recent years. When I grew up, I sincerely wanted to be Marshall Dillon and Gunsmoke, you know, and I had the lunchbox. Today, a whole chunk of this generation believes one of the greatest achievements is grow up and be the Sopranos, Breaking Bad, Sons of Anarchy, and the gang lord at the end of Grand Theft Auto. And here we come back to what makes America unique is that every other first world nation that I can find regulates children's access to media violence, except for America. My book, my new book, Assassination Generation, we talk about how they fought all the way to the Supreme Court to sell any video game to any child at any age. And we're the only major industrialized first world nation, to my knowledge, that doesn't regulate children's access to violent visual imagery. And we're paying a horrible price for it. And once again, the media knows they have blood on their hands and they got to point the finger somewhere else.
Yeah, we had a, you probably saw it, it was two Florida police officers murdered about 3 weeks ago. They were literally assassinated in a Chinese restaurant. And it was very strange because this gentleman, or this murderer, I shouldn't call him a gentleman, there was no information on him whatsoever, no picture, like nothing. And and I'm not talking about some sort of conspiracy theory, but it's, I put a little kind of social media post about that, like, why is it that we don't know anything? And you know, the kind of people bit back, oh, we don't want to mention their name, they're not worthy. And it's like, well, actually, I want to know what their history was. Were they extremists? Were they, you know, I even mentioned, you know, video games. Because you want to learn from these. It's awful, but you want to learn. And when I mentioned the video games, my goodness, I got some, you know, snappy little responses. And I've always said this way before I was introduced to your work. And when I was blown away. Because take away, you know, just down to bare bones. If you want to relax with your family, so you put in a DVD of teenagers being brutalized and tortured and murdered as entertainment, I think that's a bit weird.
Amen. Amen. And if, you know, and again, when we talk about the violent video games, so this, you know, I, all your listeners, and I recommend the book Assassination Generation. I put a copy in the president's hand a month ago. I was at the president's roundtable on media violence. Senator Rubio was there. We had two representatives. We had Brent Bozell, who's been one of the long-term leaders in the media violence movement. And we had six of the most powerful, influential people in the video game industry. And, you know, the Parkland killer played violent video games 15 hours a day. And the president turned to these people and said, we're deeply concerned about this. People are concerned about it. I hear it everywhere. Well, what can we do about violent video games? And the industry said, nothing. We don't have to do anything. You can't make us do anything. And they talked about, you know, the Supreme Court decision, which again, in my book, Assassination Generation, you get far better understanding of what happened. And I told them, you don't believe your own propaganda. You know what you did to manipulate a couple old men who never played Pong in their life. You know, the reality is our medical community is screaming from the mountainside about the harmful effects of these things. And we got this disinformation campaign from this horrendously wealthy industry. You got to understand, one video game, Grand Theft Auto V, made more money than the entire global music industry. One video game made more money than every rock concert on the planet, every musician, every concert, every CD, every download on the planet. And it's a cop-killing murder simulator. This industry is fabulously, vastly, amazingly wealthy, and they devote great resources against any attempt to limit the terrible things they're doing around the world. And in America, they've been enormously successful using the First Amendment to hide behind. But, you know, the worst thing in many ways, the most pervasive impact, is to teach children to take pleasure from other people's suffering. And I tell my audience, I say, everybody in this room, even you ladies, at one time or another, we all played toy guns. So bang, bang, I got you. No, you didn't. So you smack him with your cap gun, and it leaves a mark, and he cries. And you try to convince the hurt kid not to tell mom. Somebody gets hurt, the play stops. A basketball game, a football game, one of the players gets hurt, the fans go silent, the play stops. In healthy play, whenever somebody gets hurt, the play stops. In the video game, you blow your playmates' heads off in explosions of blood. Does the play stop? Do you get in trouble? You get points. This is pathological play. This is dysfunctional play. Can you not tell the difference between healthy play when somebody gets hurt, the play stops, and where you're conditioned and rewarded to inflict suffering? So the most pervasive impact of these games is horrendous bullying. People say, I was bullied when I was in school. It can't be worse than that. It's worse. Are the mass murders in the school worse than we were kids? Believe me, the bullying is worse. I tell everybody, remember when you were a kid, remember that bully who sincerely took pleasure in making you suffer? Because there's many, many more of those kids out there today. And that's that pervasive influence of these murder simulators in which you take, you know, you're rewarded and conditioned to to receive reward for committing violent acts on your playmates, on these individuals you're interacting with. So the harmful effects that ripple through our whole civilization. Every piece of technology had to be digested. We had automobiles for 50 years before some genius said, you know, kids probably shouldn't be driving these things. And that's where we're at. We've got this horrendous new technology that our civilization needs to digest very quickly before it destroys us. And we have this vastly wealthy industry, but deeply invested in continuing to sell the product to children.
Yeah, I wanted to kind of underline as well to make sure, again, people are listening. So you're not talking about Sonic the Hedgehog. You're talking about these cop-killing ones and the first-person shooters that mimics exactly the way the military trains some of their soldiers.
And I tell you what else. We're not talking about like civilization. I'm a huge Civ fan. Every time that the latest version of Civ comes through, I spend my limited spare time for months playing it through, you know, and my goal with Civ is always to win it at the hardest level and find some angle by which I can work the system and win at the very hardest level. Always, I must admit it, the military, I'm good at military stuff. If you win at the hardest level through any of the other methodologies, my hat's off to you. But there's a great endeavor. There's nothing harmful about civilization. You know, the graphics are, you know, so there are many good things we can be doing. But when you get these vivid depictions of human death and suffering and you're rewarded for it, that's where we got to start drawing the line and where you're inflicting death and suffering. The first-person shooters, as you well say, even others where you may not be a first-person shooter, but you're manipulating human death and suffering in vivid depictions. And, you know, the video game industry really does a good job with their ratings. They just refuse to accept any regulation of the ratings. They say, they told the president, well, we have voluntary compliance. I told you, they wouldn't buckle their baby in their car seat if it wasn't the law. You know, what if the gun interest said, well, you know, you can sell guns to a kid, but we have voluntary compliance. You know, the tobacco, alcohol, pornography. There's so many things you can sell to adults, but you can't sell to children. And we're all good with that. I'm a real laid-back libertarian kind of guy. Leave me alone, I leave you alone. But, you know, when it comes to laws saying you got to buckle your kid in the car seat, we're all good with that. But this is the one industry, the visual violent imagery, television, movie, and video games, that says you cannot regulate children's access to a product in any way, shape, or form. We have voluntary compliance. But the rating system really is pretty effective. And we talk in my book, Assassination Generation, of the video game rating system, many lies for the price of one. It's tremendously deceptive. They take the worst games and they call it M, mature, 17 and above. Every kid thinks he's mature. I'm mature, Dad. I can play a mature game. Oh, I guess so. It's the greatest, you know, insult. That's very immature. I'm disappointed. Greatest compliment. Oh, you're very mature. That was well done. So they take their worst games. They put a smoke screen out front, you know, A, 18 and above. None of them are A. It's a smoke screen. And then they take 17 and above and make it the most desirable term. But if you understand that an M-rated game is like an X-rated movie, and if you enforce it, and then you go on down through the system, T, 13 and above, they want you to think PG-13. It's not. It's a hard and fast line. Children under the age of 13 should not be playing the game. And then the biggest lie of all, E, what's E stand for? Everyone. No. You got to actually look at the fine print. Everyone, 7 and above. And they got a little E with a little 7. Everyone. You know, 5 and above. It's like, you know, it's like the tobacco industry. It's tobacco for the whole family. 18 and above. Look at the fine print. You know, guns for everybody. 18 and above. So this is a sick industry. Even the rating system and the way they do it is twisted. But if we take that rating system as a baseline to recognize the harmful games, the T-rated games, you know, Fortnite is just an overwhelmingly popular game right now. It's a T-rated game. You know, there's not horrendous violence, but children under the age of 13 should not be playing the game. It took me about 15 minutes looking online to find out what the rating of it was. I had to keep digging and looking. It's not something just right up front. But the rating system does form a pretty good baseline. People ask me Fortnite. I say, you know, if your kid's 13 and above, limit the amount of time. Don't let them get obsessed with it. You know, it's not bad. if you got an M-rated game, it was like letting your kid have X-rated movies, you know, hardcore pornography for your children. We got to enforce the rating system, but kind of a baseline. We're not talking about all these games, but remember, they took these most horrendous games and they gave the most desirable possible term, M, you know, mature. Every kid wants to be mature. So this is a very sick, twisted industry. And all of it's in my book, Assassination Generation. And like I said, I was able to slide a copy across the table to the president. You know, it was quite an experience.
No, absolutely. Well, I also want to delve into a little bit an area that when we spoke last time, I was just breaking into, and I am so passionate about this now because it's just been like the elephant in the room for a lot of the health and mental and physical health issues in first responders too. And that's the sleep deprivation side of video game use. And I didn't think about it until I heard your book. So if you wouldn't mind elaborating on how powerful that part is on some of these things that we're seeing.
Now, first, understand these video games are enormously addictive. The online games are a constant laboratory. I mean, you got the online games, and this happens, and 10% of our people say, oh, this is a good time to quit the game. So they stop doing that. And any time they find something that causes somebody to say, oh, this is a good time to take a breath and stop the game, anytime that happens, they stop that from happening. It's this constant interactive feedback loop year after year to make the games more and more addictive, more difficult to turn off. So understand these games are fantastically addictive. When you play the games, you go into an alpha state. And you actually become incapable of keeping track of time. Suddenly it's 3 o'clock in the morning, got no idea where the last 6 hours went, and your spouse is sincerely ticked off. Research tells us that in America, video games are responsible for 15% of all divorces in America. Google video games divorce come right up, 15%. And in the younger age, it's actually quite a bit higher. Not that many six-year-olds getting divorces over video games. So this horrendous, pervasive sleep deprivation, after 18 hours without sleep, your impaired judgment equal to 0.08 legally drunk. After 24 hours without sleep, your impaired judgment equal to 0.10 above legally drunk. After 2 days without sleep, you're a psychotic. Any graduate of Army Ranger School would tell you about hallucinations on the third day without sleep. So here's this worldwide epidemic of sleep-deprived children. And here are the effects. Number one, an explosion of suicide. In the armed forces, in the active duty army, our suicides have nothing to do with combat. A non-combat vet is likely to take life of the combat vet. But a sleep-deprived person can be up to 5 times more likely to take their life. Parenting 101 for the 21st century. When you send your kid to bed at night, take their cell phone away from them. No cell phone in the room, no laptop in the room. They have got to go to their room and sleep. A cop told me one time, he said, I had a good girl. He said, she was an A student. And she said, Dad, it's embarrassing. You don't have to take my cell phone every night. You can trust me. So I trusted her. And he said, a little while later, she took her life. And I never knew the hell my little girl was living in until we looked at the text messages on her cell phone. Night after night of ceaseless, relentless, vicious bullying. He said, my little girl was bullied to death, sleep deprived and bullied to death. And I let it happen. He said, I can't ignore that text message in the middle of the night. How do we expect our kids to? So understand this epidemic of suicide around our civilization is completely interwoven with an epidemic of sleep deprivation. And teen suicides around the world have exploded to levels that we have never seen before in our darkest nightmares. Traffic fatalities for decades went down. Populations up, number of people killed in traffic deaths down, seatbelts and airbags. And now in recent years, they're back up again. And teen traffic fatalities have skyrocketed. When your kid gets behind the wheel, the best thing you can give them is a good night's sleep. Before they get the keys, they got to get a good night's sleep. Sleep-deprived people, truck drivers, required by law getting a sleep for a very good reason. Sleep-deprived people behind the wheel are are horrendously dangerous to themselves and others. And then drug overdoses. The three major killers of our kids, drug overdoses, suicides, and traffic fatalities, depending on who you talk to, which one's first, second, and third, but they're all huge, and they're all related to sleep deprivation. Yeah, there's scary new drugs out there, but they're not that new. They're not that different. One of the new factors is sleep-deprived people making life and death decisions on drug doses. And so we got three factors that you as a parent can influence: drug overdoses, suicides, and traffic fatalities. You as a parent can powerfully influence by making your kid get enough sleep. Sleep is a biological blind spot. Our bodies don't know how to make us get enough sleep. You got to make it happen. And you know, I recently started wearing the Fitbit. And the Fitbit does an amazing job of keeping track of your sleep and the quality of sleep and your heart rate. You know what? Violent video games make your heart rate go up. When I play Civ, my heart rate goes down almost to the level when I'm sleeping. You know, I'll look at my heart rate scale on my Fitbit and say, wow, look how low it was when I was on the plane. And I was on the plane with my laptop playing Civilization. And I went into a state that is almost like sleep as far as the heart rate is going. So powerful, restful, which it can be addicting. And you know, you've got to be careful. But the Fitbit does such a good job of keeping track of heart rate, keeping track of sleep, monitoring sleep. You know, I think there's great value in putting it on our kids and tracking their sleep and their quality of sleep as one of the most dynamic health trends for all of us. Again, sleep is a biological blind spot. Our bodies are not going to make us get enough sleep. We have to develop the personal discipline to make it happen. And so it's this elephant in the living room where first responders and our children, our whole civilization of profoundly sleep-deprived people, and it's a technological dynamic. You know, prior to electric lighting, you know, candles were rare and precious commodities. Firewood was rare and precious. You know, it got dark and, you know, had so much talking, so much sex, and everybody went to sleep. Our bodies didn't have to make us sleep. The environment made it happen because it was dark. And now we got electric lighting and television and video games, and it's a biological blind spot. And the one area that would make enormous impact is sleep deprivation. And I've become a huge fan of the Fitbit to help us measure our sleep and see the quality of our sleep and what we can do about it.
Brilliant. Well, I'm so glad that you said that, because that's one thing I've seen as the I guess you use the expression elephant in the room for us as well. We've had a huge increase in firefighter suicides, an increase in firefighter overdoses. And I'm sure you're seeing a very similar trend in PD. And then probably if you look at junior doctors and ER physicians and that kind of thing as well, anyone that's up on these shifts, we're seeing that. And then you look further down the career, you're looking at the cancers and the heart disease because the immune system is so compromised from the sleep deprivation as well. So
let's talk about that. You know, there's an angle on this. In the law enforcement community, there are two profoundly stupid things that we're doing. One is rotating shifts. Every time you rotate shifts, you're kicking everybody in the nuts and putting them behind the power curve on sleep deprivation. It takes up to a full year to fully adapt to night shift. And then the other thing that law enforcement is doing is the 12-hour shifts. California Highway Patrol recently came out with 12-hour shifts. It was a disaster. Accidents exploded, internal affairs investigations exploded, complaints exploded. At the end of a 12-hour shift, cops are exhausted, and tired people make mistakes. Tired people do things and say things they will regret for the rest of their life. And my cops all want to be like firefighters, you know, work 12-hour shifts, get all that time off. I tell them, well, firefighters get to sleep on the job. You know, only firefighters and prostitutes make money in bed. You know, just all in fun, all you firefighters out there. You know, we love you. It's all in fun. But the truth is, a lot of our fire and EMS, they don't get to sleep during the day. The truth is, they're constantly on calls. And in law enforcement, the old timers knew what they were doing. 8-hour shift, bid for your shift based on overtime. You know, let me say that again. 8-hour shift, bid for your shift based on seniority, and put a cap on overtime. You know, you want to stay at nights for a lot of time, good for you. Stay on nights, you know. There's no need to rotate. Rotating shift takes years off people's lives. You got the seniority. You want to move the day shift. Good for you. You've earned it. You got the seniority. But what happens is the new guys come on and say, I don't want to wait to get seniority to be on day shift. This is no fair. Let's rotate shift. Well, suck it up, buttercup. Rotating shifts means everybody loses. It is one of the most profoundly destructive things we can do. It literally takes years off people's lives. I'm a huge science geek. My favorite website, sciencedaily.com. I check it every day through every category. We live in amazing times. Exoplanets and dark matter. And what is it really? You know, dark energy. What is it? And the latest in, you know, in climate science and medical science. But I'm a huge science geek. And we're learning great information on that on a daily basis. And we've got to apply that information for the wellness of our civilization.
Absolutely. And I think from the fire side, what I've found, and I've delved into sleep medicine a lot too with Kirk Parsley, and there's a new gentleman just discovered, Matthew Walker. But it seems for the firefighters specifically, because they have that facility, that station where they are able to rest in periods, the 24 is still good, but you need to give them more days after. Because right now, the firefighters are working 56-hour weeks. So the person bagging your groceries is working 40 hours, and the person doing drug calculations at 3 a.m. on your child is sleep deprived. I mean, it's insanity.
It is. It is. It's negligent. I mean, lives are irrefutably being lost because of this insanity. You know, people should rise up in outrage. You know, I tell my cops, you know, truck drivers are required by law getting asleep, but cops aren't. That should enrage us. If I were king and could pass one law, I would mandate sleep for first responders, just like truck drivers and air traffic controllers and airline pilots, nuclear power plant operators, and drug. You know, and there's dozens of professions required by law get enough sleep, including airlines. If airlines don't have a rested crew, they cancel the flight. Better no flight than a tired pilot. You know, I'm in those planes every night. I'm good with that. And I'm good with that. I don't want to fly with a tired pilot. Better to have no cop than a tired cop. However, we're undermanned. We're going to have maximum overtime and put them on the streets. No, better no cop than a tired cop. I tell my cops, we are now in a zero defects environment. And you know what zero defects looks like is the airlines. You cannot crash a single plane. Oh, come on. You know, traffic accidents happen every day. We have 100,000. I mean, we have 1 million people in the air every day. One airline crash a day is reasonable. No. Well, one airline crash a year is reasonable. No. Well, one airline crash every 10 years, that's reasonable. No. You cannot crash a single plane. You crash a single plane, we will investigate. We will put you in jail. We will fine you. We will fire you. That's what zero defects looks like. And that's where law enforcement is today. And I think all of first responders will very soon find themselves in that environment. Better to have no flight than a tired pilot. Unless it's a declared emergency. I teach chiefs and sheriffs nationwide. I tell them, you got to understand, we're in zero defects. Everything every cop does is caught on camera. And if one cop does something stupid, you will have rioting in the streets. And you want to be the next Ferguson, you want rioting in the streets. Put tired cops out there because there's no slack anymore. Everything they do is being caught on camera. And you will pay a tragic price for it. So sheriff, chief, you say, hey, if it's a declared emergency, then the blood's on your hands and I'll work my people to the bone. But until then, I will not put tired cops on the street. It's a negligent act. And you want more cops? Pay them more. Because once we dig our heels in and say, we're not going to have sleep deprived first responders. Well, we want first responders, then pay them more. And that's what's going to happen. Once we stop doing this insanity of working these people to death and having tired people out there making life and death decisions. Once we stop doing that, you're going to start seeing first responders get paid what they deserve to be paid. You want more people doing this job, then pay them more. Until then, we will not put sleep-deprived people on the streets.
Absolutely. And if you're paying a low wage, you get a revolving door too. Like my county department here, I don't even know if they're able to... I don't know what the statistics are as far as the time on in the department, but it's, you know, they go in and these men and women a lot of times just can barely afford to even pay the bills. So then they spin out again. And then coupled to that, a very, very important thing that you see in a lot of fire and police is that they're understaffed. So then these men and women are not only doing their own shifts, but they're being told the next morning after 24 hours, oh, I'm sorry, you have to stay for another 24 hours, which, as you and I know, neurologically is basically a recipe for disaster in itself.
Absolutely. That brings us back to, you know, the baseline, the social contract for every government is public safety. Everything else is secondary. Public safety has got to be right. You know, the social contract, you obey the law, you pay your taxes, we'll help keep you safe. If we can't keep them safe, the social contract breaks down. So every other aspect of government is secondary to public safety. And we've got to get that part right. And we've got to just demand that they do it and they do it right and provide proper resources and allocate the money to do it right. Those poor, like you said, your department, you know, well, who would think of the accounting department as the weak link in your chain? But any area where we underpay people, that you're going to start seeing this rotating door and this weak link in the chain and the breakdown of the process. If it's worthy of doing, it's worthy of paying them a living wage. And we've got to allocate the resources of our civilization to do that.
So we're talking about ownership from the community as far as, you know, creating the budgets to set the fire police EMS up for success. But I also want to talk about ownership of the community themselves. I grew up in England. I had weapons when I was young, but they were for hunting. I had a shotgun, I had a rifle. But then when I moved to the US, I wasn't really exposed to weapons much and used martial arts as the self-defense and a German shepherd in my house as a deterrent for crime. But I recently listened to you, listened to Tim Kennedy, some other people, and it changed my view on being the sheepdog. And this is obviously an area that you know, definitely known as one of the pioneers of that philosophy. So I would love to delve into what it means to be a sheepdog in your community.
Well, you know, what you and I are looking at is this next step up to firearms, being trained and being prepared and having those tools. I think when we look at the violence around the world, you know, I was just at the NRA conference and presented there, and I showed a list of the 20 most homicidal nations in the world. And 19 out of the 20 all had those European gun laws going to keep us so safe. The reality is that empowering our citizens with the tools to protect themselves is the only possible movement. I think we'll see Europe moving that way. You know, when the director of Interpol, a couple of years back when there were, you know, all those massacres in France, the director of Interpol said, you have to ask yourself, could this have happened in Dallas? You know, could this have happened in an American city? And maybe we got something to learn there. Israel and America have kind of pioneered this dynamic of don't take away rights, give them more rights. Entrust your citizens with the tools and the rights to protect themselves and others. And I think that's the inevitable outcome of dealing with violence in our civilization. I think you'll see Europe undergo some real dramatic changes in coming years. Europe may be doomed. They've got a negative birth rate in nation after nation. They've got the Muslim population that is breeding at very tremendous levels, and the Muslim population has told Europe in a generation we're going to own it. And so this dynamic of empowering our citizens, Switzerland is another good example of a nation that does that, one of the few in the world. We've got to understand that this is a right and a privilege, and it's got to be done responsibly. But I tell people, you know, the first step is having that firearm. And we don't want to be, you know what, I see this a lot with my Brits, you know, we've got to call them the gun snob. You know, you got to fire, you know, 500 rounds a month minimum to be entrusted with a firearm. Well, you know, there's a continuum there. My grandmother, my great grandmother in New Orleans, 1932, shot a intruder off the second floor balcony. You know, it was New Orleans summer. It was hot. The second floor was wide open. All the doors were open. All the windows are open. A guy climbs up at the second floor balcony, and Granny points a revolver at him and pulls the trigger until he goes away. You know, the ultimate point and click interface. Granny probably never fired more than a dozen rounds in her life. But, she hit with at least one of those bullets because they followed blood trail out the alley the next morning. But Granny with the revolver in the bedside stands a force to be reckoned with. You know, across Europe, we see home invasions very common. And Americans are terrifying. You know, big guy comes in the house and what can you do? Well, if you've got a firearm, it's a great equalizer. And in a world without firearms, if big guy kicks in the door, what are you going to do? In America, we've got that right to protect ourselves. That Israeli model of an armed citizen responding to the terrorists is really the only possible model. But along with that right comes responsibilities. So, proper securing of your weapon. We're doing that more than ever. And proper training with that weapon. Now, I've become a huge fan of the martial art of the firearm. Americans don't like to compete. You know, there was let me lay a foundation for this. I think your listeners will really, really like. Let me talk to you about what happened at the Draw the Prophet Muhammad Art Festival in Dallas, Texas, in May of 2015, when two would-be mass murderers, we believe it's the first targeted ISIS attack on American soil. They had rifles, they had body armor, they had the element of surprise. They rolled out of the vehicle, and a 59-year-old traffic cop with a pistol killed them both. So what I tell people is, we've got a couple of options here that I want you to have. Decide now which one you're going to be. The first option is the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida. There was a cop in the parking lot on security. He said, I heard a rifle. I had a pistol. I chose not to go in. What would it feel like to look at 49 dead bodies? No, they'd all be alive today if I'd have had the confidence in my skills to go in. Odds are 50-50. You'd come in behind the bad guy, shoot him in the back. He'd never know you were there. And that have such poor skills, such total lack of confidence that you don't even go in. I most of us would live the rest of our lives, in hell, knowing those people died while we quivered outside and didn't even go in. So the mass murderer in the Pulse nightclub pops out of an exit, chasing down two people who are running and shoots them in the back as they run away, and then engages the cop. The cop had no choice. The cop's behind the vehicle. The vehicle's riddled with bullets. The cop fired most of a magazine. Those who are there tell me it was less than 30 feet away, fired most of a magazine and didn't hit once. So, obviously, there's a reason why he didn't go in. He had no skills. He had no ability. And same with Parkland. The cop didn't go in. That cop's being sued. If you were on the jury, given what you know now, what would you decide? I'd drive him to the ground like a tent stake. And he deserves to be, where cops can be destroyed for not shooting, for not going in. We need to understand that. So understand the limit that they're in. But go back to the outside of Dallas, Texas, Garland, Texas, the Draw the Prophet Muhammad Art Festival. Could they be more provocative? It was their right to do it. They were afraid to draw bad guys. And two art critics from Arizona showed up with AK-47s and body armor. It could have been the Pulse nightclub times two. They had the element of surprise. They had body armor. They had rifles. Now, some of you may not understand the body armor cops wear stop most pistol bullets. Rifle bullets just wave on the way through. So if the bad guy's a rifle, it's neutralized the cop's body armor. If the bad guy has body armor, he's neutralized the cop's pistol. Body armor stops pistol bullets. And unless the cop's making headshots or pelvic shots, you understand the enormous disadvantage a cop with a pistol's at. That rifle's punching holes through his body armor like it ain't even there. And that body armor is stopping the cop's pistol bullets. So they roll out of the vehicle, and Officer Greg Stevens, 59 years old, 37 years on the department, and never once drew his gun to life and death event. But he trained for a lifetime. Anytime the range was open, ammo available, he was there. In many cases, it's been his own time and his own money to prepare for a lifetime for that one day. He was 40 feet away. They fired over 30 rounds of AK-47 fire and never hit once. He's 40 feet away on the passenger side. The vehicle stops, both doors pop open, and he immediately, the hair stands up in his head. He said, I wasn't even conscious of drawing my weapon. He said that the bad guy on the passenger side, 40 feet away, spins out and swings around and shoots a rifle at him. He said, I cannot tell you who fired first. I'll tell you who fired best. He put a volley of four on the bad guy and put him down. Bad guy's got body on him. They can make him pelvic shots, put him down. From 40 feet away, draw and fire, snapshot. Draw, fire and effect. And you know what? He said I had a sight picture for every single shot. Not a perfect sight picture, but a good enough sight picture for every shot. Fires the volley four, puts that bad guy down. And then he moves kind of laterally and in. So he's moving toward the bad guy, but he's also moving sideways. Bad guys have tunnel vision too, and lateral movement takes you right off their radar screen. So the bad guy on the driver's side wounds an unarmed security guard. We tell people, you cannot call unarmed people security. You'll be sued. You'll be successfully sued. God bless all the brave people that do that job. Unarmed people are not security. Call them safety. Call them a Walmart greeter. Call them run like hell when the man with the gun shows up. But there's legal liability associated with the word security. So he wounds an unarmed security guard on the other side and then spins around and starts shooting at Greg Stevens. And Greg's done an initial movement and fires another volley at this guy and puts him down. Accurate shots, if you're closing a little bit, maybe 30 feet. Now, the bad guy on the other side is grabbing at his throat, the one that's already been shot on the passenger side. Greg Stevens, for all he knew, the guy had an igniter. They both had backpacks, could have had bombs. The car could have been loaded with bombs. The guy might be setting off an igniter. Greg spins around and puts several more rounds in the bad guy's head. And then the one on the driver's side, he said he's still kind of moving and pushing up. He could hit an igniter any minute. He said, I've got two rounds left. The city's paying for the ammo. Game over. Tac mag change, check 360. Who would not want to shake that man's hand? I got a photograph of him. Just Google Officer Greg Stevens and Obama and see the photograph of President Obama putting the Congressional Medal of Valor around this man's neck. So which one are you going to be? And what I tell people is there was a time in the 1970s when the World War II veterans were still running the show. Right up to the 1970s, the World War II vets were our sheriffs and our chiefs, our sergeants and our captains. And they honored the roly-poly little guy on the pistol team more than anyone else. They all had a pistol team, and they honored pistol marksmanship above all else. Officer Greg Stevens had manifested that. We'll grow old, and we'll grow fat, and we can still be one hell of a shot. And they honored the roly-poly the old guy on the pistol team above all else, because they knew the one skill that mattered was pistol marksmanship. We'll all grow old. We may put on some weight, but we can still be a hell of a shot. And so I tell my cops, you got to seek a hobby that reinforces your survival skills. And nurturing your pistol marksmanship is a great thing to do. But this generation is not big on competition. But look at the martial arts as a model. 20 million Americans are the martial arts. We love the martial arts, striving for the next belt, striving for a standard. Only a couple thousand actively compete. So there's the martial art of the firearm, Hojutsu, H-O-J-U-T-S-U. And I'm a huge fan. Hojutsu.com. It's a Hotel Oscar Juliet uniform, Tango Sierra uniform.com, Hojutsu.com. And that'll take you to Soke Jeff Halls, the founder, a 10th degree black belt in the martial art of the firearm. Jeff Hall is the most decorated Alaska state trooper. He's a Vietnam Ranger right at the end of the war, one of only about 30 grandmaster pistol shots on the planet, high level martial artist in many different fields. And he's resurrected the martial art of the firearm. I thought I was good. I'm a gun sight grad, I'm a front sight grad. I do a little competitive shooting. I like to shoot. I showed up on one of the three-day weekends and barely qualified brown belt. You shoot for your belt. I worked for 2 years to make my black belt. I knew what shots I was missing. There's one kata at the black belt level. It's a great kata. It's got three weapons retention moves built into it. Transition from armed to unarmed fire. And the actual course of fire for qualification for jiu-jitsu is amazing. It's all target under time. Jiu-Jitsu practitioners have now had well over 20 gunfights with right at a 99% hit ratio of over 20 gunfights. An amazing, amazing record. So for those who want to push that envelope, practice and establish standards, but it's hard to, you know, if we're not actively competing, and that's a good thing to do, but if we're not actively competing, you know, how do you constantly improve? And the idea of the firearm as a martial art and striving for that belt. Look at the Jiu-Jitsu dojos that are going in across America. Get one of those 3-day weekends. You'd be glad it did. It's one of the best things that ever happened to you. I think that it was put here for just such a time as this. The idea of the martial art of the firearm is just the time is right. If you're a martial artist, if you have a dojo, you want to push that next standard, the next growth industry, I think you'll see a lot of success with putting together a Jiu-Jitsu dojo and pushing that envelope.
Yeah, I think that sounds like a great idea. And I want to go back to something you mentioned before, though. Officer Stevens, 37 years of not drawing his weapon. However, 37 years of preparing for the day that he was going to draw his weapon. And I think that's something that's lost a little bit, certainly in my profession. And I know in my department, even right now, there's that mentality of, oh, it's never happened, so we're fine, instead of the reverse psychology, which is every day it hasn't happened, we're getting closer to the day it does.
You know, I tell all my audiences that sometimes the greatest love is not to sacrifice your life, but to live a life of sacrifice. You know, we're not all called to sacrifice our life for our nation, but to live a life of sacrifice. Greg Stevens led a life of sacrifice. He prepared for a lifetime for that day. He took his own time and his own money. Every time the range was open, ammo available, he was there. Be ashamed as a law enforcement officer to have the range open, ammo available, not be there. And most departments have got some kind of program where periodically the range is open, ammo is available, the range guys are there. It's like you know, having the golf pro available and the golf course open for free. You know, when my classes, we mock golfers a lot, but it's all in fun. But we can all look at how we spend our money, how we spend our time, to better prepare for the time. And, you know, 9/11 was the first attack on American soil of an external war. You know, if you think of 9/11 as an act of war, it's the first attack on American soil since Pearl Harbor. And we live in a world where that attack could happen again anywhere. You know, I think that what we might see is daycare masters and schoolmasters on some dark morning. It will destroy our way of life and cripple our economy. But the answer to that is to prepare for it. And, you know, the last time we thought we might truly be invaded in the darkest hours of the Cold War, in the early 1960s, when we truly thought the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Russians were building, they could come across the border in Europe any day. We really didn't have the institutions in place to stop them. The darkest days of the Cold War, the President of the United States, John F. Kennedy, said today, and he said, my own home state of Massachusetts, we had the Minutemen, citizens who were prepared to rise up at a minute's notice to fight for liberty. He said, today we need a nation of Minutemen, citizens who believe it's their daily sacrifice to prepare for the moment of truth. You know, we've got two kids' books. One kid book is the Sheepdog Kids book. These are on Amazon.com. They're really making a great impact. But the first Sheepdog Kids book is mostly first responders and military. And people say, well, what about a civilian sheepdog? So the next one is Why Mommy Carries a Gun. And it's a great book. We found the most awesome artist. We talk about all the things. If anybody in the family is going to carry a gun, here's what you want the kids to know. You know, stop. Don't you find a gun? Stop. Don't touch. Get an adult. The four universal gun safety laws, responsible ownership, and securing the Second Amendment. And we've got a famous sheepdogs throughout history and in the book Gunfighters in America. You know, you got Harriet Tubman, who always carried a gun, you know, the great Underground Railroad engineer. They called her Moses because she led so many people to freedom. And then she was an armed scout in the Civil War, you know. And And she always carried a gun. The wanted poster said, looks harmless, but carries a pistol, when she was running the Underground Railroad. We've got Eleanor Roosevelt. As the president's wife during World War II, she insisted on driving herself and going on her own. And the Secret Service will at least carry a gun. And she carried a gun. She trained with it. When FDR died, she went back to New York, got a pistol permit, carried a gun for the rest of her life. You know, there's sheepdogs that that we've got in our book, but we also got that quote from John F. Kennedy, and we got a series of quotes in the back, and about training and about preparing and about needing a new nation of Minutemen who are prepared to sacrifice. John F. Kennedy made them sacrifice for their nation. He says the cause of liberty, the cause of America, cannot succeed with any less effort. So it's time for patriots to rise up, to train themselves, to prepare themselves. The enemy can strike any time. State of Kansas passed a law authorizing all first responders to carry. The firefighters, EMS, I'm told across America, on most fire trucks, in most states, in most ambulances, in most states, there's a gun somewhere. But in Kansas, they've led the way, and I think you see a lot of other states that are doing it. That's that Israeli model. That the first responders are all responsible first and foremost for their own security. Firefighters in Israel are armed. EMS in Israel are armed. You know, we all are the first line of defense for ourselves. So just that whole idea of pushing that envelope, empowering our citizens, empowering ourselves, is not enough just have the gun. You got to train with it. You've got to seek that training. You've got to strive to be better. Are you going to be Officer Greg Stevens, or are you going to be standing there with the president putting a medal around your neck? Are you going to be that unknown officer who didn't go in the Pulse nightclub? Are you going to be that cop who didn't go in at Parkland, who was fired and will live the rest of your life in hell, labeled a coward, and with the blood of those children on your hands? Are you going to have the confidence to sacrifice your time, sacrifice your money, train, and prepare for your moment of truth?
Amen to that. Absolutely. And then I want to just kind of add to the gun concept as well. I did the sheepdog response with Tim Kennedy. And the other eye-opener is, yes, you own a gun and you have to be able to do the training with that. But then the other element, your physical fitness, your health, your awareness of the situation, and your ability to end an incident without a gun. You know, if it's something it's just a physical altercation, where your only option isn't to kill because you're morbidly obese and, you know, letting the pharmaceutical companies have in all your money instead of putting it into protecting your family.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing about jiu-jitsu, again, is you're expected to have an unarmed art. It can be Krav Maga. It can be, you know, any of the Oriental martial arts. It can be Stemma. But you're expected to have a parallel at every level. And so you can it's integrated into that. But, you know, and it's easy to say right now, I'm 61 years old, but still in very good condition. But it gets harder and harder every year. You know, it's easy to say that while we're young. But when you're 60, when you're 70, I think you'll find it gets harder and harder. And so we want to stay in good shape as long as we possibly physically can. But we're all human, you know, and we'll all hit that time when we're too old to take an ass whooping, and the only option is to take that gun out and defend yourself with it. But if we can possibly avoid that, if we can stay in shape, I love the martial arts. I love every aspect of it. But, you know, we don't want to be this physical fitness snob that says, you know, right up to the end of your life, you'll be able to, you know, fight one-on-one. We're all human. We all grow old. It's this balancing act, just like, you don't want to be the gun snob that says, you know, if you're not willing to do all this training, you can't have a gun. But on the other hand, if you do have that gun, then you have that drive to get better with it. And the same thing with physical fitness. Every one of us should, our first priority should be to keep our body in the best possible shape. And yet we're all human. We all have various diseases and things that as the years go by that weigh upon us. And one thing we can all do right up to the end is be able to be proficient with that gun. We'll grow old and we may grow fat, but we can still be a hell of a shot.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I just want to ask some wrap-up questions. But before I do that, there was one question I asked you. I remember, I haven't got it written down, but I remember asking you a year ago. And I just want to see if you still have the same answer. So I asked, with you being, you know, so well-versed in war in general, do you see, you know, an end to war anytime? And your answer back then was maybe in 100 years. Now, has that changed at all, or is it pretty much the same?
I think there may be cause to see an end to war. You know, with the end of the Cold War, a guy wrote a very famous essay about, you know, the end of war and the end of history. That, you know, nations with McDonald's never go to war with other nations with McDonald's, you know, and well, the missing ingredient, though, was that whole impoverished Islamic belt around the world that needs to be integrated into modern civilization one way or the other. And what we're really doing is we're facing a battle, and that needs to be resolved. And I think I've got a faith in the constant path forward of civilization, that we can very well see it happen. The other thing we've got to get control of is just the horrendous, harmful effect of violent visual imagery inflicted upon children. So until we integrate this this impoverished and isolationist portion of the Islamic world and fully integrate them into modern civilization, and until we get a grip on this new technology of violent visual imagery inflicted upon children, there is no hope. But I can think of two conditions that that can be met, and thereby would give us pretty good hope that we may do that. That's to integrate this new technology of violent visual imagery and how harmful it is on children at every level, and then to recognize the fact that there's a portion of our world civilization that one way or the other has to be dragged kicking and screaming into the modern world, and that is this how are we as a civilized world gonna deal with Islam around the world and their integration, and the ultimate answer to that is yet to be determined. But there's still cause to hope that 100 years from now we could see our great grandchildren living in the kind of world that at the end of the Cold War people thought was coming, and they always have hope, you know, that for an ever better world and ever better civilization, and we sure need to get it under control. There's so many threats to their existence of our planet, our species, that need to be brought under control.
Yeah, and it's crazy when you look fundamentally that most people on the planet just want to, you know, see their kids grow up and have food in their stomach and a roof over their head, and we all share that same common goal. And it's the, you know, these crazy ideologies that end up creating so many conflicts and genocide around the world.
And you know, that comes back to my book On Killing. On Killing now has sold 500,000 copies worldwide. It's translated in at least 8 languages. Marine Corps Commandant's required reading. And you know, for your listeners, in a nutshell, On Killing, people point some horrible crime. Oh, that proves we're all killers. That's an outlier. There's more of those outliers, you know, and that should concern us. But you explained to me that 99%+ of our civilization will go a lifetime, never kill anybody and never try to. Explain that. Divorce, infidelity, layoff, traffic accidents. And well over 99% of our citizens go a lifetime, never kill anybody and never try to. Explain that. You know, that's On Killing, that resistance to killing. And then how we have to over, healthy people have, sociopaths don't have that resistance. Healthy people have to be trained to kill. And oh, by the way, the violent video games are doing the exact same thing to our children that modern training does to military and law enforcement to empower killing. And that's really On Killing in a nutshell. You know, don't focus on that 1 in a million horrible crime. Focus on the vast, vast majority of a lifetime and never kill anybody, never try to. You know, that should give us great hope. To understand that the vast majority of citizens, like you say, just want to lead a quiet life, be left alone and able to raise their families and have their children, you know, have a safe environment to thrive and raise our grandchildren. And all of us want to bounce our grandbabies and our great grandbabies on our knee and in our old age in a safe and secure world.
Absolutely. Now, it just reminded me of one thing I was going to talk about as well very quickly. Have you heard of a company called C3 Pathways?
I don't think so. I'm rings are very famous though.
Okay, so it's run by a retired fire chief, Bill Godfrey, and I had him on the show. I actually went down to his facility because he's local here near Orlando, but it kind of ties in very well because he's using basically video game software to train for active intruder events. There we go. Got it in about, 60 minutes. but what he does is he creates, it's initially just on a screen, but he gave me an introduction to his virtual reality version. I actually went in and played a police officer and cleared a room. But you bring in all these agencies. So you have dispatch, you have police officers, you have fire, you have, all the elements that you would need in one of these events. And they run lifetime these scenes. And even to the point where I come across you and you've been shot, it's real time. I have to do my interventions and you will real time bleed out if I don't do it properly.
Amazing.
Yeah. So I just want to bring it around when we're demonizing, and demonizing in a good way, some of these awful murder, torture elements of video games and movies, that there are so many great applications if we change focus.
Right. And here we are using it responsibly with adults, in a disciplined structure. And I mean, that this is a great tool with enormous benefit to our civilization, like automobiles. And except, we got to say, this is something children cannot do. That this, adults can find great value in automobiles, but your 10-year-old can't drive a car, period. Never allowed under no circumstance. That's a great example of the positive impact of when our civilization finally completely digests this new technology.
Yeah, exactly.
It gives us great hope. Once again, great cause for hope.
Yes, yeah, and a great, great training tool. I was amazed that it's funny though, the way it unfolds, he's being used all over the country, but we've still got to persuade our local agency here to actually use him, which is insanity again, but that's another podcast in itself. But anyway, well, let me ask some of the closing questions that I asked you last time. We'll see if you have any new stuff for us. So the first one is always, is there a book that you love to recommend to people? I'll have all your books again listed on the webpage for this episode. But is there anything you've come across in the last year that you've raved about?
Yeah, and I appreciate you mentioning my stuff. Assassination Generation is a defining book right now. All of these questions, it's a culmination of a lifetime of effort. The book For Our Times, my book, Assassination Generation. Off the top of my head, there's a couple others that are valuable for military, valuable for this. Across that broad spectrum, nothing recent that I can throw out there to your listeners. I really think these two children's books that we've done, the Sheepdog Kids book and then Why Mommy Carries a Gun and Assassination Generation. I feel real good about bringing those together for this point in time. I've got a book coming out. I got a great co-author doing most of the work on it. It's called The Bulletproof Marriage. And it's very scripturally based. It's straight out of scripture. So it's very Christian, biblical based. It's 90 days to enrich your marriage for military and law and first responders. It's coming out from Broad Street, which is a major Christian publisher, in a couple of months. I just finished off the little forward piece to it just the other night. Got the manuscript to the publisher. It's called The Bulletproof Marriage. And it represents one of the great needs in this community is to guide our relationships within that first responder community. And of course, the spiritual side of that whole world is another angle. If you're inclined that way, if you're pointed that way, that can be of value to you.
Brilliant. Well, I look forward to that coming out, and I'll make sure we list that in the webpage as well. All right. What about a movie? It's funny because we've been talking about movies a lot. A good positive movie or documentary.
For adults or mature teens, the movie 12 Strong was an amazingly valuable movie. It deserved a. We live in a crazy media times. I think Saving Private Ryan today would be the same as 12 Strong. The media is just not talking about it. There's just this dearth of information on it. And It's based on the book Horse Soldiers, about the first special forces team in Afghanistan. Just a tremendously well done. You know, and there's a scene in there where you see the Taliban murdering a teacher. And in real life, the Taliban would murder the teacher and the children. In 2009, we had 600 reported attacks on schools of school children in Afghanistan. Take that incident and think about it, 600 times a year. And that's what the enemy does when they really want to shred your way of life. Their Sunday punch, they hold them back, what they have not done to Europe, what they have not done to North America, what they did 600 times a year in Afghanistan is to hit those daycares and elementary schools and to understand the threat and to understand the amazing courage in the opening days of that war in Afghanistan. The best movie I've seen in a very long time, 12 Strong. You need to catch it.
Yeah, I've seen it already, actually. I had Fahim Fazli. He's Afghani born, and then he came over to the U.S. and was so enamored with the opportunity that America gave him, because he'd actually gone to Hollywood, he'd become an actor, but he became an interpreter for the Marines and went back out to Afghanistan for several years to help the communication between the Afghanis and the soldiers. So another amazing story. But he was actually in 12 Strong as well. He was one of the horsemen that they rode with.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Yeah, incredible. So, but that's, you know, that's an American. You know, that's someone who comes here from a different country and understands that they want to be part of making this country truly great, not just waving a flag and, you know.
Yes. And there's a great example of a book he made me think of. It's a book, The Horse Soldiers. I know there's a very humorous scene in the book that they could have put in the movie. It would have taken 5 seconds. It's a great sight gag. But, you know, these special forces guys are these, you know, they're great athletes. They're scuba divers. They're skydivers. They're just enormously balanced, in incredible physical condition. And here they are riding horses, some of them for like the first time of their life. And so they're on this huge switchback coming down a mountain. You know, you zigzag down this mountain and this big zigzag. And at the back of the formation, one of these special forces soldiers' horse slips off the side of the mountain. And the horse is skittering down this mountain, and the special forces sergeant is just hanging on, you know, like, from like the man from Snowy River, you know, you see a lot of that in that old movie. And all of a sudden he finds himself at the front of the formation. And, you know, it's just an incredible feat of skill and balance to stay on top of the horse. And the horse is kind of shaking, and the guy's acting like, yeah, I meant to do that. And he talks very quickly to the commander who's at the front, and the warlord says something, and they turn to the interpreter and say, well, what did he say? He said, you are the bravest man and the finest horseman in all of Afghanistan. That would have been just this great sight gag. It could have taken, you know, could have taken 10 seconds. But the book, The Horse Soldiers, is a great insight into how a small group of individuals can make an enormous impact on the path of our civilization.
Yeah. And just when you were talking about the school as well, I want to add this as well. When you hear that kind of anti-war, anti-soldier sentiment, when you hear, and I've had many of the special ops guys on here, When you hear them saying, when you watch, you know, acid getting thrown on a child by someone, you know, you're not going to let that happen, or someone's about to, you know, you start to put yourself in that human perspective, whatever the politics were that initiate that particular conflict. When these men and women are on the ground seeing these horrendous acts towards other humans, especially children and women, you start to reprogram your mind as to, well, what would you do? Of course you would stop that as well. All right, so the next guest then, is there a person that you would recommend to come on this show as a guest to talk to the first responders of the world?
Yeah, I think Jeff Hall, the founder of Hujitsu, would be a great guy. That's the first one comes to mind to me right now, given the, you know, the events and the things we're talking about and the idea of first responders taking that next step up. You know, you're right. First responders see these horrible things and they say, I'm not going to let this happen in my life. I'm not going to let this happen to my loved ones. And there's this, you know, tying in with what you just said, there's a dynamic in first responders wanting to to be sheepdogs in their own lives and protect their loved ones from these horrible things that they see. I put Jeff Hall at the top of that list. Shoot me an email. I'll get you in touch with him.
That'd be fantastic. Thank you. Actually, I think Lauren Christensen would be another great guest as well.
Lauren's just one of the most amazing human beings. You know, Martial Arts Hall of Fame, high-level martial artist, a writing fiend. He's closing on 50 books, a Vietnam veteran, a retired police officer. He's one of the most amazing Renaissance men of our times. And yeah, Lauren would be a great guy.
Brilliant. I'll be greedy and ask you for two then.
I can do.
Thank you so much. All right. So the very last question before we talk about where we can find all of your work is, what do you do to decompress?
You know, I tell you, I like to shoot. I've got a range in my basement. It's nothing fancy. I'm only home one or two nights a week. I like to shoot. My wife and I, we get on a cabin on a river, and I like to canoe. She does a little photography. We just turned 61. We broke our piggy bank and I got an RV. We're going to do a little RV in with the dog. You know, I like being around the dog. When I'm on the road, I get all my, you shoot the gator closest to you, you know, and there's nothing immediately that needs to be dealt with. When I'm on the road, I like to break out a video game. I like the Civilization games. I like that type of very in-depth, very long, intricate, interwoven game with steady progress. It's enormously rewarding and relaxing for me. When I look at my Fitbit, you know, if I'm on the plane, I'd say, look at there. My heart rate went right down to where it is when I'm sleeping. What was I doing? I was playing Civ. You know, I was on the plane playing Civilization. Very relaxing. The first shooter games, your heart rate goes up, your blood pressure goes up. There's a totally different kind of game there. So when I'm on the road, what can I do? I read. I'm a big science fiction fan, and I do a little, like I said, I do a little video games when I get a chance. And when I'm at home, I like to shoot and spend time with my family and my dogs, and life is good and rich and full.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for taking your time to reach out to us, not only the first time, but the second time. I mean, I feel kind of greedy with getting you on, but you're just such a wealth of knowledge. So where can people, after listening to this, find more about you, find the books, and any other project that you've got out there?
Our website's killology.com, and we link it to a lot of other stuff. You know, we do our Sheepdog House of Worship security team training every Saturday at sheepdogseminars.com. But really, the primary website for everything we got with the links to all the other directions is killology.com. My son is a genius, is a master gunsmith. He's got 8 patents to his name. And his gun business is sheepdogknifeandgun.com. Sheepdogknifeandgun.com. We just got that website redone and up to a nice level. We've got some patented firearm safety innovations that are really making some great headway. And that would be something worthy of looking at as well.
Fantastic. Well, again, I want to thank you so much. It's an honor to speak to you, because I mean you're revered in so many fields, and especially the military. But so, like so many people that I've had here, I see these philosophy and these teachings that are so pertinent to the profession that I'm in, whether it's police and fire and EMS, and to have someone like you talking about it and adding more clout to it. As you said, my whole point of this podcast is to get people pissed off and to start changing things themselves. So,
well, the same back to you, my brother. It's an honor to be on board with you. Thank you for what you do. To you and all your listeners out there, believe in who you are, believe in what you do. Our civilization desperately needs what you have to give.